like, when we talk about, like, whether or not Jefferson is right wing or Madison is right wing or either John or Sam Adams, you know, today there's a tendency to shit on them, which I actually don't love. I mean, I think they're guilty of a lot of things that they're being accused of. But I'm also like, well, you know, you know who else had slaves at one point? Toussaint Louverture. So
yeah, I kind of feel like the cunning of reason is a very useful expression, very useful concept. It doesn't matter how good or bad a person might be in your eyes with your lens from your time, because your time only exists because of the people who came before, and they did things despite even wanting to. They just did anyways.
I mean, we could talk about people who were better or worse about it.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, you know, I think Jefferson's a particularly interesting character because he, on one hand, clearly thought slavery was wrong, and then on the other hand, only freed the slaves he had when he died that were his direct heirs.
Right.
Like, which even George Washington was better than that.
And Washington, I think, didn't Washington write the first fugitive slave law?
Yeah.
So it's like he was a nice guy. Across the board, I mean, yeah.
Another weird one is someone like John Adams, who I consider, if you read John Adams against Thomas Jefferson, Adams reads like he's more conservative, right? He does. But he's better on women and he's better on slavery.
Actually, it's because of those two things I was going to say he doesn't seem more conservative. But
that's because we focus on that today. But yeah, if you like, right. He thinks that like the presidency should be practically a kingship.
Yeah, I think, didn't he also oppose the Bill of Rights?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, okay. That's a really good example of what I'm talking about, right?
Right.
With this set of conditions, with these parameters, he's very much for simplicity's sake, he's a conservative. With these other parameters, he's very much a progressive.
It's interesting to me when people always talk about how much more left-wing Europe is than America, and I'm like, well, but Europe actually defines conservatism.
Right.
America doesn't really know how to deal with it. We have to invent a conservative tradition in the 1950s, basically, and it's invented.
Yeah.
Russell Kirk sets out to take a bunch of different groups, neo-Confederates, the agrarian post-Confederates, the Federalists, Cold Warriors, James Burnham, who did consider himself a conservative himself at this point, but like, T.S. Eliot even, and creates an American conservative tradition, but he creates it. It is an invented tradition by Russell Kirk. Like,
yeah, it is very incoherent for that reason.
Right. I mean, it actually is interesting that that's like the incoherence of both Goldwater and Reagan fusionism, even though that's really late. Like, Goldwater and Reagan fusionism is just a generation before me when it really begins.
Yeah.
Like, I think people...
weird to think about, but yeah.
It is, and it's already kind of gone, right? So even though that's defined... That was, by the way, the political movement of the late 20th century until George Bush and neoconservatism in its full instantiation horrified everybody, including a lot of conservatives. That was where all the movement of conservative action really was. And not just conservative action, but all left and liberal action was happening in response to it.
Right.
They were setting their terms.
Yeah, completely.
But it's funny because, like, you can see the hints of how incoherent Reagan fusionism is going to be. And it's not the exact same as what Russell Kirk throws together, but in Russell Kirk's the conservative tradition, because Kirk basically invents that shit to cart to provide an intellectual tradition to a motley grab bag of stuff that had kind of, you know, aligned during the Cold War from what we now would call paleoconservatism, but they didn't understand themselves as that yet, to, like I said, quasi-neo-confederate, neo-confederates outright, people like Richard Weaver, Whitaker Chambers, you just have, and part of this is also so that you can move away from the kind of like American conservatism is not elitist until recently in the same way that European conservatism used to see itself. European conservatism, I don't think, also doesn't really see itself as elitist anymore. Or if it is, it's like hiding it. But
yeah.
But every now and then, you see a Tory in the UK who still has a whiff of it, like Rees-Mogg Davies or whatever.
That's what, right? I've seen of. Yeah.
But in general, you don't see it that much anymore. And I guess that Bourbon guy who still claims, or not the, there's both a Bourbon and a Bonaparte who both claim to still be the rightful rulers of France, like those guys, like, but they don't have any political capital whatsoever, really. So
yeah, they're just a sideshow.
Right.
And it's funny because at one point people that were in that in those traditions mattered a whole lot in France, like a whole lot. But they still need more at all.
So you have a European defense of the order that emerges in response to the revolutions, basically. But the conservatives don't really want any of the Ancien regimes, except for maybe defenders of the Habsburgs. But even that seems to be they wanted the Habsburgs to modernize too. So then in America, conservatism seems to be, it is not really a political orientation. It is kind of a religious orientation. It's still hard to talk about conservatives and liberals in the United States or Canada in the 19th century. Much that there are liberals and there are more liberals, but I guess you have the neo-Confederates who see themselves as defending, they weren't the neo-Confederates yet. You have the Confederates who see themselves as defending an aristocratic planter order. They're conservatives, flat right. out. And you have some Federalist with elitist inclinations for old money, but to call them conservative before even the 1890s is really hard.
Clean cut. It's more obvious when you're talking about the Confederate and the pro-Confederacy milieu.
Mm-hmm.
That's much more clean cut. But
absolutely.
The other one, not so much, I don't think.
Well, once the Confederacy's out of the question, you have, the questions are all around how you're going to reintegrate, how radical you are going to be to reintegrate the Confederacy. And then the Democrats are the conservative party, except that what makes that weird is both populists and progressives start liquidating. Well, progressives liquidate into both parties and populists liquidate into the Democrats before the 20th century.
Right.
By the
end of Reconstruction, there's already a totally different, the deck's been reshuffled twice. And so if you're not talking about socialism versus capitalism, the left and right conservative and progressive, they barely mean anything.
Well, and the capitalist and the socialist, I mean, literally, because one of the things you have to remember, Marx talks about how many of the socialists in Europe fled to the transatlantic republic, and he means they're coming to the United States.
Right.
And they fight for the Republicans in the Civil War. Yeah. And a lot of them are aligned with the radical Republicans, but they know they're defending a bourgeois order. They just think they're defending the more progressive one. They're afraid of the emergence of some kind of hybrid aristocratic bourgeois order, some kind of hybrid demon beast of capitalism and aristocracy that could emerge in the Confederacy.
Well, yeah, and looking back from this century, I think they had a point.
Right.
In fact, not enough people were worried about that.
If anything, I mean, what I find interesting is I was always taught early on that the assumptions that socialists had that, like, that the economic world would just make slavery irrelevant because it was not going to be as productive as free labor.
Yeah.
That Marx hedged his bets both ways when his writings on this. And he talked about, like, the slavery economy contributing to the capitalist order, but also being separate from it. It makes it very difficult to parse, like, what he actually thought. He seems to have things that, like, oh, no, there's this way, like, you could actually see in the South a capitalism with slave aristocratic, not even feudal, like pre-feudal, slave aristocratic characteristics, which would be a nightmare beast, because it is even more unstable than Bonapartism, right? Because it's just like this has elements of ancient human oppression in it, and also it has all the benefits of capitalist machinery and order and can develop it on its own,
right?
Like, and Marx did seem to get that.
There's a reason why ultimately, at least formal slavery had to go away. Because it was a fetter.
Well, yeah, and that's why everybody joined to destroy it in some ways. Yeah. Like, including the British Empire, who started it in the fucking, chattel slavery in the first place. Well, the British, the French, and the Belgians. I mean, we can't just blame the British, but, like, and the Portuguese. Actually, the Portuguese are the people who really, really started it.
Well, and the Spanish.
And the Arab traders, and the Congolese Empire.
But when it comes to the United States, for the most part, we should look to and blame the British.
Yes. Fuck them.
I mean, we should now also. For every question, the real problem is the British.
So it's interesting to me that conservatism, like, in the United States is a weird question, particularly even as late as the 19th century, wherein I think in the European case, there is a clear set of conservatisms that exist by the beginning of the 19th century. And the reason why I was going to bring that up is I'm like, okay, so we mentioned all these late 18th, early 19th figures, right, as the kind of forerunners of modern conservatism. The British case around Burke and the conservative Whigs. It's interesting that the Tories themselves do not factor into this. I guess they are too monarchist to be considered part of a conservative tradition and may be seen as part of a traditionalist or reactionary tradition. Thus may not be linked in the same way until later. Like, it actually takes the establishment of a formal British conservative party in the 50s to bring British conservatism and British Toryism into one thing. People might correct me on that, but that does seem to actually be a fairly late development, really tied to say Quentin Hogg and co around the late 50s. For those of you who don't know, Quentin Hogg was the second Viscount of Helsham, which is a cool name.
I don't know anything about this, but now I want to.
And he was a conservative party politician. I mean, I guess the conservative party, I am wrong. Conservative Party clarified its identity in the 1950s, but it actually goes back to 1834. But it was not originally called the Conservative Party. It was originally called the Tory Party.
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
Its origins as a, like, as a kind of unionist group, would later call conservatives. That happens in the 1890s. And then in the 20th century, it becomes what we now think of as a conservative party. But it's what it is, a continuous party.
Right. Okay.
Kind of how, like, there's the Democrat Republicans who become, who, oh, I say this, the Federalists die, the Whigs die in the United States, who are the descendants of the Federalists. And then the Democratic Republican Party is kind of a split, actually. Like, because you can kind of, I know that, like, Republicans will claim they're the party of Lincoln, but they're also kind of a split from, like, Whigs joining with dissident elements of the, you know, like, the descendants of the Jefferson Party. So.
Right.
And what makes, you know, so in the 20th century in America, the Republicans, who are, to my mind, the Republicans in the United States are a bourgeois party. They are, like, yes, technically the Democrats are a bourgeois party, but their origins actually are somewhat muddled, because they kind of actually come from a time period where bourgeois relations in the United States were not the only relations.
Right. They have a, you know, they have, some of their roots are in a landed aristocracy, which doesn't exist. Some of their roots are in the kind of a frontier yeoman farmer types.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, I mean, Eugene Debs called the Democratic Party the, a petty bourgeois party. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like it was a yeoman early bourgeois party that became a, then a planter party, then a petty B party versus a big B party. So that's what you have in the United States. But that the weird coalition that, from the nature of the early Republic, actually, that created the Democratic Party, because it actually spans this time period of, like, bourgeois relations is clearly emergent. It clearly kind of exists in France and England, and in parts of Italy, and in, you know, beginning to exist in the, and, you know, the German principalities. But it is not coherent. And it's not even coherent in the colonies. Simultaneously, like, when people talk about the, interestingly, when people talk about, oh, you know, like, whiteness and capitalism linked together, I'm like, no, they're not necessarily, but it is interesting that's also, like, when white identity coalesces in the United States, and a whole lot of other stuff happens, right? Like,
right.
These modern terms that we think of in now that are, like, abstractions and extensions of things that are human, like, that really develops in this time period. And one of the things that's interesting, like, we think of, like, racial nationalism as, like, the ur form of conservatism, right? That's not coherent to Demestre, Burke, or Mitterrand, who's the other person I would link in, like, the early founders of conservatism.
I know less about the other two, but for sure with Burke, it's almost like a anathema.
Yeah. Gorbineau and Azouaz were both liberals, and they're kind of the people who really, like, get really into, like, white racial theory. Like, I don't think Gorbineau is just a liberal. Gorbineau is weird. Author de Gorbineau, Essay on the Inequality of the Races. He's, like, before him, there are, like, vaguely scientific notions of race, but they're vague, right? And Gorbineau really liked people like Josiah Nott and Henry Hotze and what's his face? I'm actually trying to remember the most famous person here. Slave defender. Still has schools named after him. It's funny. We're so up in Europe. You can tell as you get older, I can seem to think of Europe and I can think of the United States, but I can't think about them in the same time.
I mean, part of the problem is that doesn't narrow it down too much.
No.
slavery like, defender who still has schools named after him could be at least a few people.
But this guy wasn't like, this guy was like pro-slavery in a, I mean, I'm not even talking like pro-slavery like John Locke. I'm talking about like real,
John C. Calhoun.
Calhoun, thank you. God, I can't remember. I couldn't remember. Like, it's like James Henry Hammond and John C. Calhoun. Okay, like, it's like, let me remember my villains of history.
Well, yeah, Calhoun's one of the great villains of history.
Right, right. So Gorbanow was taking inspiration from them, but he's the person who, like, tries to make it a biological. Like, he, like, right. You had this nascent notion of biological race going all the way back to the Portuguese, but they don't, like, even in, like, the founding fathers who talk about, like, the superiority of, like, white culture, they think they can kind of, they do think that, like, they're not sure about black slaves, but, like, they go back and forth on whether or not they think you can make, like, indigenous people white, you know, culturally, like, or whether they're biologically capable of it or not.
Like, yeah, like, when was the one drop rule implemented?
Oh, that's, I think, that's one,
it's fairly late, right?
Yeah, I think one drop rule is actually after the Civil War. That is the 20th century.
Yeah, so that just goes to show how much, you know, a few centuries ago can't really be discussed in precisely the same terms as right now.
Yeah, that is a 20th century. It was codified. It was argued about in the 19th century. George Tillman, like, for example, talked about it, but apparently it was Tennessee and Virginia who implemented it. In the South, and it spread throughout the South, starting in Tennessee in 1910 and ending in the late 1930s. So yeah, that's completely modern.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
that's as a result of the overthrow of slavery.
Right. So one of the interesting things that I want to point out here is we can't abscond the Americans for European conservative batshit. We were contributing to it, but there are people who codified it. Like, we learned it from them. They learned it back from us. It's in a feedback loop. That's if you're in the French and English speaking world. Now there's a separate kind of weird conservative tradition going through Catholic reactionaries in New Spain / Latin America. So,
right. And a different conservative tradition when it comes to Germany and German speaking countries.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that you can say that's interesting, why in the 19th and early 20th until World War II, Germans were generally seen as more progressive than everybody else. Right. Well, what are the reasons why? One is you got all those socialist Germans who came over after 1848, and two, right. And Germany was doing all this cool scientific work in the late 19th century.
They're also doing a lot of really cool literary work.
Mm-hmm. The non-conservative romantics until they became reactionaries later. But like if you're comparing Goethe to Coleridge. Coleridge ends up like way more reactionary than Goethe. Like, it's
and Wordsworth also,
yeah,
switches sides, a lot of them do,
right? So you have that, then you have other problems, like the person who I can't categorize, for example, Hobbes. Why can't I categorize Hobbes? Because Hobbes has modern liberal assumptions.
Yeah, like, in context, for his time, Hobbes was probably more of a liberal. And today, Hobbes is probably more of an inspiration for cultural conservatives who are desperately trying to be more than just cultural conservatives.
Right. Well, Hobbes is interesting. I mean, there are some, I know some people who think of themselves as leftists who are Hobbesians, but like, are at least Hobbes sympathetic, Colin Drum, for example. But Colin Drum hates it when I call Hobbes a liberal. Right. But I'm like, well, Hobbes assumes universal human equity, a social contract.
I feel like that's the social contract is the main thing.
And he also assumes that like it's actually human equality that leads to human hierarchy, that like humans are essentially equal. That's why there's a hierarchy that's artificial, like, and imposed by violence. Like, that's not what anyone before Hobbes would have argued.
Right.
And in fact, royalists, of whom Hobbes was definitely on the side of, were terrified of Hobbes's theology. Hobbes was also like he was religious, but he seemed to be a true materialist, and like he even thought that God was material. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah. It's a very small section of global society that can fit into there.
But Hobbes is interesting because, I mean, in that sense, British liberalism is post-Hobbesian. But Hobbes actually accepts many, like, traditionalism as understood by someone like Evola or Eric Leiden or Nicolas Gomez de Villa or even John Lukács. And that's not even getting into, like, weird leader traditionalist. Traditionalism would have been totally foreign to these guys. Like, to Hobbes, I mean.
Right.
So, even though he's considered a conservative figure now, and later conservative figures like Smith are really inspired by Hobbes, but that actually illustrates the problem. Like, if you try to, like, there's a reason why people don't generally consider Hobbes the founder of modern conservatism. Libertarians will sometimes say, well, he's the founder of modern leftism, but they forget about, like, the general state skeptic orientation of leftism going all the way back to before Marx.
I feel like, I know it's a cheap shot, but, like, I can't think of anything that any libertarian has ever said that made me really think at all. And there might have been some, and I just missed it, but I feel like it should be more common than whatever, however common it is.
So, yeah. Well, I think to me it's weird that it tells you something about the nature of capitalism that libertarians end up on the conservative side of things.
Right.
Like, because it doesn't really make that much sense. Like, So we have established in our nature of conservatism talk here two theses and some key figures, and we've established that there's a feedback loop between Europe and the settler colonies, mostly America, but also Mexico. There are key conservative thinkers in Mexico and
Canada.
Canada's still a major exporter of conservatives. They don't gain power there. Like, yeah. Canada, like, I don't know what it is about Canada. Canada's major experts are like tar sands oil. And conservatives,
it's because they're so upset about the frankly undeserved reputation that they have of being so left, because they're really not at all.
No, they're not. They are obnoxiously liberal sometimes, but historically, no, they're not. And actually, Canada is also really interesting about the difference between American and European conservatism, because Canadian conservatism was split between American and European aligned branches. So traditionally, conservatism in Canada was actually closer aligned to Britain and like red Toryism, etc., like going back to Disraeli. And only in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that really start to split. and it was not clear where it was going to go for a long time. It took Harper really to make it clear that like Harper really made it clear that British and American conservatism were no longer so different that they couldn't be reconciled is what it really meant.
Right. Well, because, what like, Harper did is what he did is he made it clear that neoconservatism is a globalist phenomenon, just like liberalism.
Right. And what, you know, what that French guy whose name I can't remember might prove is like somehow Trumpism is a global phenomenon, much like liberalism, which is weird because I'm like, I don't even know what that is. No one does. But.
Well, the simple answer, I mean, it's just because everything is a global phenomenon now.
Well, so here I want to here, you know, I've said this many times before, but Trump to me was a sign of the final Europeanification of American conservatism, which I think everybody, including your European listeners, are going to be shocked by. But I'm like, no, Trump's weird elitist quasi populism. That's a late 20th century European kind of conservatism. That's, a, you know, now that the blood and soil and the fascism and all this stuff is not flow. And like, even like, except in very few cases, no one really like bats eyes at royalist anymore. Like even in places that have a monarchy, like
with the exception of like Father Coughlin, there are very few figures of the right in the last 100-150 years with a populist appeal.
Yeah. Father Coughlin, the silver shirts, but these are all like a minority positions in the United States. They are actually,
George Wallace, maybe.
Right. Well, this is where the neo-Confederates and the Dixiecrats are confusing.
Yeah.
Because in some ways they're proto-neoliberals, in other ways they wanted some elements of the welfare state maintained for some people. And they're adjacent. I always get Blue Dog and Yellow Dog confused. Yellow Dog.
You know what else? With the exception of the segregation pillar, Wallace, at least as far as I can tell, from a very cursory look, didn't really have a lot of positions that really characterize, oh, like that's what a Wallace guy thinks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He's just a racist, and that's it. Otherwise, his economic policies are pretty standard, you know, liberal and conservative.
So, yeah, he was a racist populist. And actually, when he, like, remained governor of Alabama, he eventually even tries to drop the racist part.